So Tom came into my office a couple weeks ago, I think, and he asked me whether I was willing to give a talk about neutrinos and lattice QCD, and I said no, because lattice QCD, of course, deals with strongly interacting particles, and so far there are no strong interactions anywhere to be seen near neutrinos. Of course, that may change once we find new physics that gives rise to the neutrino mixing matrix and masses and so on, and that physics, of course, may be connected to what gives quarks their masses and the CKM matrix for quarks. So what I will talk about is what lattice QCD has to say about the CKM matrix. And here's the outline of my talk. I'll give a brief motivation into lattice QCD. I'll give you a quick introduction into what the lattice is in lattice QCD. And I'll give you a review of some of the results that have been obtained in lattice QCD of some of the most important processes. I will say a few things about some very recent developments, which are very, very exciting, and prospects for the near future, which are basically calculations that are in progress now. I'll point out some of the dirty laundry we still have to wash, and then give you conclusions. So motivation. The motivation here is, this is the rho eta plane, which parametrizes some of the CKM angles. And the different physical processes, the different parameters that give constraints in the rho eta plane. And the bands right now are very large. And the reason why these bands are large for most processes, except for the CPA symmetry from B decays, is because these error bands are dominated by theory. And if the B factor, after the B factories have stopped running, and we assume only incremental progress for the theoretical errors, then this is a situation roughly that we'll be faced with. In other words, the error bands are still rather large. This is just assuming that the error, we somehow managed to half the error bars, the theoretical error bars. So this is not a very satisfying situation. What's the problem? The problem is probably well known to all of you. If I look, for example, at an exclusive process such as the semileptonic decay of a B meson into a pion, then the differential decay rate can be parametrized as some known factors, the CKM matrix element, and a form factor which parametrizes the hadronic matrix element. And this form factor needs to be a theoretical input, and of course, because it's non-perturbative, it's very hard to calculate except with lattice QCD. So for all these processes, we need non-perturbative inputs from lattice QCD in order to be able to use the experimental measurement of differential decay rates such as this to determine the CKM matrix elements with real precision.
And you can point out there's a neutrino in that decay.
And as Tom points out, there's a neutrino in that decay. Okay. The goal is to get theoretical errors that are of order 2 to 3%, and then we really have very small bands here, and we can maybe even discuss whether there is a discrepancy with a standard model and whether there is new physics in here. And probably that discussion wouldn't be done in this rho eta plane, but in other ways, but that's just an illustration. So the question is, can we ever get there? Can we get there in this lifetime, given the history of lattice QCD? So by the end of the talk, I hope I'll have answered that. So let me go into an introduction for what lattice QCD is. The lattice refers to discretizing space and time. So two nearest neighbor space-time points are now separated by a finite distance. That finite distance is the lattice spacing, which I always refer to as little a. And when putting the system on a computer, one also introduces a finite box size. So fermion fields live on the sides, and the gauge fields live on the links between the sides, and they're usually written in this exponential form. This just allows me to write the gauge field theory in a gauge invariant form on the lattice. So now I have to discretize the QCD action. So if I just have discrete derivatives, I write them as, if I have a discretized derivative, I write that as a discrete difference. And then my QCD Lagrangian, if I look at the derivative term here, then I will approximate the derivative by the discrete difference operator over here. If I want to do better than that, then I'll have to add correction operators to this expression, and these correction operators will scale with a positive power of the lattice spacing to take care of the dimensionality of this operator. The coefficients of these operators depend on the QCD parameters. Those are the short distance coefficients that basically take care of the stuff that's between the lattice spacing. So those depend on alpha sub s and the quark masses. They're typically calculable in perturbation theory. So then I could, for example, start out with a discrete derivative like this, then do better and add the correction term in it. I do have to calculate the coefficients, and that's where perturbation theory comes in often. Sometimes this can be done non-perturbatively, but this is a short distance coefficient.
How many corrections can be included in this way? I mean, up to which term?
Okay, I'll come to that, in fact, in this slide. So in general...
So if you check it, there's a perturbation theory, but you're doing something non-perturbative, is that okay?
Because I have separated... I have a scale in my problem. The lattice spacing is a scale, so I can separate long and short distance physics. So, and the question is, how well does perturbation theory work? That's been investigated very well. For example, you can look at you do a numerical calculation on a very, very small lattice. You know, so you make the lattice spacing teeny tiny and look at a very small lattice, so you have a short distance quantity that you're calculating, calculated physical quantity, compared to the perturbative expansion. See that you get the right result. Some of these coefficients can, in fact, be matched non-perturbatively. Usually, in order to do the calculation non-perturbatively, you need some sort of symmetry, you know, in order to do a non-perturbative calculation. And again, that works out pretty well. So, but the point is that the calculation of these coefficients is the most time-consuming part. Writing down the operators that contribute, you know, the correction operators, is very easy, but calculating the coefficients is where all the work goes in. And, you know, you do this at tree level, then you add one loop, and so on. So in general, I can write my lattice Lagrangian in this form, coefficients plus times operators, and of course, this is how the QCD Lagrangian itself is written too. So in general, my lattice Lagrangian will approximate the continuum Lagrangian plus terms that disappear with a positive power of the lattice spacing. And this is not just for the Lagrangian, this is a statement that holds true for physical quantities. So if I look at any physical quantities calculated on the lattice compared to the continuum, there will be differences which vanish with the positive power of the lattice spacing. The errors here scale with the typical momenta of the particles in the process. So if I have gluons and light quarks in my process, then the momenta of the gluons and light quarks is lambda QCD, so the errors scale as lambda QCD times A to some power. So I need to keep lambda QCD, I need to keep the lattice spacing small compared to lambda QCD, or the inverse lattice spacing large compared to lambda QCD. Then lambda QCD times A is small compared to 1, and then this is a good expansion. So for typical lattice spacings of about 0.1 Fermi, 1 over A is about 2 GeV, so that's certainly good. Good enough, as long as N is large enough. So the game for doing this is, one of the most important ingredients is this improvement, is adding correction terms to the action so that N is large, so that these discretization effects are as small as I can make them. And here's the state for gluons and light quarks. Originally, Wilson wrote down an action for gluons which had discretization errors which grow as the square of the lattice spacing. This was improved upon by Lucia and Weiss, reducing the lattice spacing to alpha s squared times a squared and a to the 4. Okay, so these errors are, as I'll show you later on, actually quite small. For light quarks, Wilson's original action that he wrote down had errors that are linear in the lattice spacing. So those are actually large, This was improved upon by Shaikh al-Islami and Volat, and with the Clover action, the errors are reduced to alpha s squared, a, and a squared. So one of the effects, and again, in answer to your question, Tom, one of the effects of only having, knowing these coefficients perturbatively is as I add correction terms, I will get powers here. Okay, so if I knew this coefficient non-perturbatively, I would only have a squared errors. I know this coefficient to one loop, that means I have alpha s squared a errors. But alpha s, of course, is also small at the scale of the lattice spacing. So that's the difference between perturbative and non-perturbative improvement. There's another formulation for light quarks that's the staggered formulation, which starts out with a squared error. And in the last few years, this action has been improved. This is called the ASCTAD action, and it has alpha s times a squared errors. And I'll show you some results in this. This action is, in fact, and that's why it's in red, is the most precise light quark action we have to date. This is work that was done by the Mill collaboration, and some of this was proposed by Peter Lepage, and the Mill collaboration has really established this action as a good action to use for light quarks. And I'll come back to that. One of the senior collaborators in the Mill collaboration is Bob Sugar. The Mill collaboration is a collaboration of lattice QCD theorists who are spread all over the country. They've been working together for ever. And they've been doing a lot of work in establishing lattice QCD.
It originally stands for MIMDI lattice computations because we started working on MIMDI parallel computers. And we were looking for something that sounded like a word, but got Toussaint in Arizona at Grand Colorado, hiring the floor, Steve Cotton, MIMDI, and Bruce Heller, who's now at APS, and Claude Bernard.
And postdocs. So it's I think altogether maybe at least a dozen, maybe 20. Okay. So the title of my talk was The Charm and Beauty of Lattice QCD. I've only talked about light quarks and gluons so far, so let me talk about heavy quarks. When I have a heavy quark, the heavy quark mass will be large compared to lambda QCD, or in lattice units, the quark mass won't be small anymore. If I go back here, when I've written down these errors here, which, you know, they all scale with lambda QCD, of course, I've assumed that the light quark mass is much smaller than lambda QCD, so that the dominant scaling is lambda QCD times A, and M times A is much smaller than lambda QCD times A. Okay, so these actions, these light quark actions, were written down in that limit where the quark mass, is small compared to the lattice spacing.
So that's a good approximation for the first three quarks?
That's certainly a completely justified approximation for the first three quarks. And it is obviously not such a good approximation for the charm quark and for the beauty quark. At typical lattice spacings, the charm quark mass in lattice units is about 0.2 to about 0.3, you know, depending on the lattice spacing, sometimes a half. So that starts to get worrisome, and the B quark mass in lattice units at the lattice spacings that we have available to us is always bigger than, in lattice units, is always bigger than 1. So you cannot use these formulations to deal with heavy quarks on the lattice. However, you can do different things. There is two frameworks for dealing with heavy quarks on the lattice, and the first one starts out with Well, QCD has a non-relativistic limit. That's non-relativistic QCD, very similar to non-relativistic QED. And you can write down the effective non-relativistic Lagrangian, and then you can discretize it. And so this was done almost 10 years ago now by Lepage and collaborators. So this is a formalism which is valid when the quark mass and lattice units is bigger than 1. In this language here, it corresponds to expanding these coefficients, which are functions of quark mass, in powers of 1 over m, and also selecting some different operators here. As a result, what happens in this formalism is I'll have errors which scale with the typical momenta of the particles in the process, and I have errors which scale as p over m, just as they do in any effective theory. And the power of n here depends on how far have I done the non-relativistic expansion, and the power of n also depends on how many improvement terms I've added to the action. Okay, what happens in this formalism is there are no terms that grow with a heavy quark mass. So there are no terms that grow as AM quark. So there's no uncontrollable errors in terms of the quark mass. The Fermilab approach, this was developed by Kronfeld, McKenzie, and myself, starts from a different point of view. We noticed that the Wilson action, the relativistic Wilson action, that was written down originally and improvements thereof, have the same heavy quark symmetries as QCD. They're just discretizations of QCD. So these actions have, in fact, the same heavy quark symmetries as QCD. And if I calculate these coefficients and keep the full mass dependence of these coefficients, then what we find is that the lattice action smoothly matches the heavy quark limit, or the non-relativistic limit, and the light quark limit as I change the quark mass. So in fact, there are no errors that grow with quark mass. The only reason why I have errors here that might potentially grow with quark mass is because when Wilson and company wrote down the light quark actions originally, they were expanding these coefficients in quark mass. As it turns out, these coefficients are smooth functions of quark mass, and there are no singularities. What you want to do is you do want to add a space-time asymmetry to the action so that correction operators also include non-relativistic operators. And again, those are smooth functions of quark mass, so these become important when the quark mass is large and become unimportant when the quark mass is small. And with all of that, you can do this to any order in improvement and get an action that's valid for all quark masses in lattice units. And we've shown that errors never grow as positive powers of the quark mass. You might get, depending on how you do the matching, you might get errors that go as p over m when the quark mass is large, or you just get errors that go as the power of the typical momentum in the problem. So what we cannot do here in this formalism is we cannot deal with large momenta, but we can deal with large masses.
Did you refer to both heavy quark mesons and heavy light?
Yes. Yes. It's the same. In fact, and this is true for this approach as well as this approach. You know, you're dealing with the heavy quark action, and you can use it for either heavy light system or heavy system. The analysis of lattice spacing errors will be different because, of course, the momenta in a heavy system and a heavy light system are different, and also the relevant scaling of the correction operators will be different in the different systems. But, you know, so you will end up with different kinds of errors, but the formalism certainly applies. And in fact, the way it works out is if you look at improving heavy systems, then the heavy light system, the errors in the heavy light system are usually much smaller than the heavy system, because in the heavy light system, the momenta of the heavy quarks are of order lambda QCD, so you always get something that scales as lambda over m. In the heavy system, momenta are more like mv, so the momenta are larger. So discretization errors tend to be larger.
Are the light quark masses the electroweak masses? 5 MeV, 10 MeV?
Yes, yeah.
And then, so you assume the lattice self-consistently dresses up the mass?
That's right, because the gluons are there. The gluons and the C quarks are there. So this is just like QCD. You have a, you know, these are the, if you want, these are the bare parameters that then give me the, that then give me the hadron masses. So I put in the bare parameters, and out come, when I calculate a hadron mass, a hadron mass, and then I can translate the bare parameters using perturbation theory, you know, to MS bar or whatever other scheme I have. So those correspond to the 5 and 10 MeV masses. Okay, so let's talk about systematic errors, because if we want to talk about you know, results to 2 or 3% accuracy, or 10, you know, if we put numbers there, then we have to discuss systematic errors. And I've already talked about finite lattice spacing errors that calculate some physical quantities on the lattice, and in the continuum I have to deal with these discretization effects. And of course I can take the continuum limit by brute force. I do a calculation at one lattice spacing, keeping the physical volume fixed, I then decrease the lattice spacing and so on. The computational effort of this grows roughly like 1 over the lattice spacing to the 6th power. The reason why it grows with the 6th power, not the 4th power, is because there's some critical slowing down also. So the computational effort grows very rapidly. Another way in which I can take the continuum limit is by improving the action. Improving the action means the computational effort grows much more slowly because I add a few correction operators. That means that the simulations become a little bit slower, maybe lose a factor of 10 or so, but I don't lose that big a factor. So improved actions obviously are much better in taking the continuum limit. In the end, you want to do a combination of both. You want to improve until you see very little variation as you take the continuum limit. And let me illustrate this. This is borrowed from the Mill collaboration again. In 1999, they did a study of different light quark action, and it's this study that established the improved staggered action as the action of choice. What they show here is a rho meson mass versus a squared. These are some funny units in terms of the lattice spacing squared. Roughly this point over here corresponds to 0.14 Fermi. And what you see is that all these different light quark actions, if I extrapolate them to the continuum, they all extrapolate to the same point. That's good. But there is one, and the blue points here, that are flat. And the blue points are, in fact, this ASCTAD action that Milk developed. So any other action has much larger, at finite lattice spacing, has much larger lattice spacing artifacts than this action. In fact, it appears to be really, really flat. And even at 0.14 Fermi, lattice spacing errors appear to be much smaller than the statistical errors here. This is just a design study that was done in the quenched approximation, which is why they looked at the rho meson mass, but this sort of thing doesn't depend on C quark effects. So this then establishes the utility of the improved staggered fermion action. Other systematic errors. We often talk about chiral extrapolation or light quark dependence. Where does that come from? As it turns out, in numerical simulations, we keep the light quark mass bigger than the physical up and down quark masses because the computational cost grows for small quark masses. And the computational cost just becomes at some point the computational cost becomes too big. So typically one ends up with light quark masses which are larger than the physical up and down quark masses. And one issue is also which formulation of light quarks allows me to go closer to the physical up and down quark masses. What if I get to light quark masses that are small enough, I can use chiral perturbation theory to extrapolate. If I want to do this, I need, of course, light quark masses that are small enough. So I do need light quark masses that are smaller than half the strange quark mass in order to extrapolate, in order for chiral perturbation theory to be valid and to be able to extrapolate. Okay, this you know, going to small light quark masses is, as it turns out, much easier for staggered than for Wilson-type actions. In fact, staggered actions, depending on how light you go, are a factor of 52,000 more efficient in going to light quark masses than Wilson-type actions. Another issue that we have to deal with is finite volume effects. Typically, in today's simulations, finite volume is about 2 Fermi. Sometimes it's bigger than that. Sometimes it's a little smaller than that. And that's okay for most of the quantities that I'm going to talk about here today. But that's certainly an issue that once you get to less than a few percent errors, we're going to have to revisit. Finally, let me talk about the most troublesome systematic error. In fact, this systematic error that has plagued lattice QCD for over 20 years, and that is the so-called quenched approximation, which has been with us almost since the conception of lattice QCD. And this comes from, this is an approximation where quark loops are neglected in the simulation. So in this approximation, I have gluons to all orders, non-perturbatively, present in the so-called brown muck, but I don't allow the gluons to split into quark-antiquark pairs. What's the reason for such an uncontrolled approximation? Again, is computational convenience. This process is related to a determinant, which needed to be calculated every time I changed the gluon field in my Monte Carlo update, and by using this approximation corresponds to setting the determinant to constant. So, you know, actually calculating the determinant increases the computational effort by a factor of 1,000 or so. So that's the reason why people, when they started doing lattice QCD calculation, started out in the quenched approximation. We now know that this introduces a systematic error of between 10 to 30% into the calculation. So that doesn't really, this is not an approximation that we can live with if we want to have quantitative results that can be used in CKM physics. So as I just said, including dynamical fermions, quark loops, into the simulation is computationally difficult. And, you know, it's much easier if I can keep the lattice spacing as large as I can. And so here the need for improved actions is pretty obvious. So far, up until last year or so, people had been just doing basically engineering calculations with dynamical fermions using staggered or clover fermions. And 2 flavors, not the real world, because the real world has 3 light flavors in the simulations. Up until Milk came along, and last year they started showing results with 3 flavors of dynamical fermions. This is using this improved staggered action, and so they have 3 flavors. They have a strange quark mass, which is non-degenerate with the light quark masses. The up and down quark masses are treated as degenerate, so that's okay as long as you're looking at isospin average quantities. And then they look at a range of light quark masses. So there's lots of light quark masses below half the strange quark mass. So with these light quark masses, one can actually do a chiral extrapolation and hope to have control over the chiral extrapolation.
Is it possible to say in a few sentences what a staggered fermions are?
The 2 formulations, Wilson versus staggered, address the doubling problem. And if I write down the naive action, just take my derivative, discretize it, and you know, use that as my action, that's called a naive action. You know, just do the simplest thing you can do, because the discrete derivative and momentum space will give me a sign instead of a p. It has, in each direction, there's 2 poles. So what I end up with doublers. I end up with 16 flavors instead of the 1 flavor I want in the continuum. That's the doubling problem. What Wilson did is, and that's why the Wilson action starts with errors that go linear as the lattice spacing, he introduces an additional dimension 5 term into the action, which breaks this degeneracy. So it lifts the energy, if you want, of the doubling states up, and now I end up with only one fermion, one physical fermion. So that's Wilson's solution. This, what staggered quarks do is they stagger, so the residual quark flavors are treated as parts of the quark that I want, and so the quark flavors are staggered over the lattice, and that's why it's called staggered. So it's a geometrical approach. So instead of trying to remove the unwanted flavors, you know, I use them to reconstruct the continuum fermion. And that's where the term staggered comes from. This was developed by Kogut and Susskind. Is that a good explanation?
It sounds like a much more complicated action.
It's more complicated, and a single quark is represented by a field which is non-local. And that's at the heart of the improvement, is to get rid of errors that are actually arise because different components of the quark fields are slightly different gauge fields because they're on different lattice fields. Are you going to say anything about the
yes.
quark group?
Yeah, that's the dirty laundry under
that's
issues.
That's what I don't
think. Sorry, how do you say error was estimated of the quantum quarks you mentioned systematically? Why do we know that it's not 40% of 20?
This is rough, and this is just by doing the calculation, by calculating the light hadron spectrum, by calculating lots of different physical quantities in the quenched approximation, and then seeing how well they compare with experiment. Okay.
There are some things that are 100% wrong. For example, the quenched approximation predicts that no strongly interacting particle decays by the strong interactions. So rho goes to 2 pi. The amplitude for that in the quenched approximation is 0.
Right.
Okay. That's 100%
right.
Wrong.
Right.
Or
right. Incidentally. Yeah. So this statement applies to processes that don't, where you don't have a strong decay associated with it. So if you look at just hadron masses and so on. So you've already made some selection as to what quantities you're going to look at.
So for example, when you do this MILK 2002 and compare to the quenched approximation, are there some processes where it turns out that the difference is actually very small, and therefore you don't have to worry about a more complicated formulation?
I think AIDA will show you that, but the problem is you don't know before you do the calculation.
Yes. Yeah.
So what you'd like to do is calculate something you don't know the answer to.
Yeah, so I'll show some results of that. But the point is that with the quenched approximation, you'll have the spread. So there are quantities that don't see a big effect, and there are other quantities that see a big effect.
Just as you have a process which is 100% wrong, you can't account for it. Maybe some processes that,
there are,
perhaps in hindsight, but maybe in foresight, you can imagine it doesn't make a difference.
Yeah, there are processes like that, or it doesn't make a big difference. And some of the quantities, for example, are charmonium and bottomonium states below threshold. You know, they... the decays are highly suppressed, and so they don't feel the absence of quark loop effects. They mostly feel the gluons, and so they're the differences between including quark effects and not. Are, you know, you would expect a priori them to not be so sensitive to that, and I'll show some results to that too.
People weren't stupid about this. They've been doing this for 20 years and understood. In a rough way, you know, when it might be reasonably 10-30% that I thought about when it was completely wrong. This is an improvement, it's not the problem.
But the point is, of course, the final point is that with configurations that include dynamical fermions at this level, we can finally, you know, forget about this. So now I'll talk about that in more detail. Finally, the last systematic error is perturbation theory, which I've already alluded to. This comes from momenta, you know, the perturbative renormalizations between continuum and lattice quantities come from, you know, say matrix elements, come from momenta of the order of the ultraviolet cutoff. So again, those renormalizations are calculable in perturbation theory as long as the lattice spacing is small enough. So at lattice spacing of 0.1 Fermi, alpha sub s itself is about 0.25. So if I use one loop perturbation theory, I end up with roughly 5%-ish errors. So that's okay if I have results that are 10%-ish or so accurate, but for results, if I want to do a calculation with few percent or less errors, I eventually need to do some of these renormalization with two-loop accuracy, and that's difficult. Lattice perturbation theory is much more difficult than continuum perturbation theory. Lorentz invariance is very powerful, as we all know. I mean, it simplifies calculations enormously. Of course, we've had lots of experience with lattice perturbation theory, and this is especially difficult with improved actions. Because, you know, in the continuum, the vertex is one term, it's gamma mu. With the simplest action, it's a line. With an improved action, maybe as long as a page. So this gets very difficult, but people have developed tools in order to deal with this. There's something called automated perturbation theory, where you start out from any action and have an algorithm, a computer algorithm, that develops the vertices and propagators. So you do the loop integrals completely numerically. There's other computational methods that have been developed. There's numerical methods, you know, calculating quantities on very small lattices and then matching them to perturbation theory. And there's also non-perturbative methods that people develop trying to do this matching non-perturbatively. So there are there's been a lot of work, and this work has shown some fruits. For example, the self-energy of a static quark, which is one of the simplest things you can calculate, actually, has recently been calculated to three loops. This was last year, by two different groups, and they get actually good agreement. So that's a tour de force that is quite impressive. So we are dealing with this. This is something that's in progress. Right now, Trottier and company, they're working on doing the calculations that are necessary to determine, to do the matching for alpha sub s to two loops. So having said all this, let me talk a little bit more, and this is in the vein of also of what Bob said. What are the easy lattice calculations? What are the quantities that we think we can get to with reasonable accuracy? So first of all, I want stable or almost stable hadrons. A rho meson that decays is not going to be dealt with very easily, even with the milk lattices, because it is not going to have a good chiral perturbation theory, because it's going to undergo a threshold, for example. So I want to look at stable hadrons. I want to look at hadron masses, at amplitudes or matrix elements where I have at most one hadron in the initial and the final state. And so those are the kinds of quantities that I want to look at. So here are the kinds of mesons. I can deal with pions, kaons. I can deal with D sub s, B sub s mesons, and I can look at masses, decay constants, mixing matrix elements, and the matrix elements for semi-leptonic and rare decays, as long as I can parameterize the matrix element in terms of at least one hadron in the initial or final state, sandwiched between a local operator, I can do the calculation. Other states are Charmonium and Bottomonium states I've already talked about. All the states that are below open Charm or open B threshold, and again, very similar quantities can be calculated in lattice QCD.
What do you mean here when you say things like B star and D star are almost stable? That's almost stable, evidently,
well,
for your purposes.
Again, I mean, this is actually, this the D star and the B star is pushing it. And it's not clear that we can get as good an accuracy on those as we could on the D meson, for example. The point here is that the D star width is still quite narrow. So almost stable, meaning a width that's small enough. And that remains to be seen. So some of these quantities will be able to do better than others. But you want to push it a little bit.
Should the width be small compared, say, to lambda QCD?
Well, I think that's a good question. So that's something we would need, you know, we want to study. You know, how well, you know, can we get the B star? If we can get B's, B quantities to, you know, 2% accuracy, how well can we do with the B star? So I didn't want to exclude them a priori, but those we want to, you know, we need to study. For CKM physics, the quantities that are interesting all involve pseudoscalars. Excluded are rho mesons and any other resonances where the width is not small compared to lambda QCD. So there's easy quantities for most CKM matrix elements as shown here. And so most of these CKM matrix elements can benefit from lattice QCD calculations if we are in fact able to use the Milk lattices and to use the advances that were made due to Milk developing this highly improved staggered action to do lattice QCD calculations of a few percent or so. So let me give you briefly the status of some of the quantities. So I'm going to start talking about F sub B and B sub B. In the quenched approximation, this quantity has been calculated for, I don't know, 10 years. And, you know, people finally understand it. And this, you know, if you look at successive averages, at each lattice conference, we have a lattice conference every year, and at each lattice conference there's a review talk on heavy quark physics, and each reviewer will give an average of FB in the quenched approximation because that's what people have calculated for so long, and this average has been stable. Basically, people agree on what this is, and of course the dominant error then is the fact that this calculation is done in the quenched approximation. What I want to emphasize here is that with an improved heavy quark action, this is a result from us, but other people have obtained similar results. You can look at the lattice spacing dependence of FD and FB, and you can see that these quantities don't depend very much on lattice spacing. So the point being that all the errors are under control except for the quenched approximation. And here you see the typical review, you know, all the different groups agreeing with one another, and similarly also for B sub B, and then you get results such as this. You know, and the interesting quantity here is C is the ratio of F sub B sub S squared divided by B sub B times B sub B divided by the B sub D quantity, and that's one of the interesting quantities.
Are you going to say more about C?
Yes. So last year, the only NF not equal to zero results involved two flavors, and the standard lore was that yes, we see when we include dynamical quarks into the simulation, we see that S of B increases. This was in fact anticipated by, you know, doing kind of quark model arguments about the effect of C quarks. If you think of F sub B being a quantity that's sensitive to the wave function at the origin. So, you know, you expect that it would increase, and it increases by about the right amount. What they also noticed, what all these calculations saw, is that if I take the ratio of F sub B sub S over F sub B sub D, that ratio is roughly independent of the number of flavors. It agrees with the NF equals zero result. So that was, up until last year, the standard lore. What was new last year was that people started to worry about chiral logarithms, because I've told you how difficult it is to control chiral and control light quark effects if you deal with light quarks that are large compared to the strange quark mass, that are larger than half the strange quark mass. In that case, the chiral expansion, the chiral isn't really under control. And in fact, in most of these simulations, people weren't really able to see the chiral logarithms, which we know are there. If you include them in the chiral extrapolation, then that would increase this ratio to roughly 1.3. And that, of course, also increases the systematic error. Last year, the Mill collaboration presented a result with NF equals 3, but they also used heavy balanced light quarks because they used clover light quarks. So what's the problem with the chiral logarithms and F sub B? So I've already talked about in this, when the light quark mass is larger than the up and down quark mass, use chiral perturbation theory, for example, to extrapolate F pi to the physical up and down quark masses, and this is well known in the continuum and on the lattice. Chiral logarithms are known, and even in the quench case, they're known, where they're not so important. And this formula here shows you that the chiral log becomes important once the light quark mass is small enough. So I really need, in order to see the chiral log, I really need light quark masses in this range. If I'm outside of this range, then this looks just like a straight line. For F sub B, the coefficient of the chiral log isn't really very well known. This coefficient here is related to the B star B pi coupling, which is poorly known. You might try to guess it from a measurement, a clear measurement of the D star width. That's also controversial. So in essence, this coefficient isn't very well known. So the chiral log term isn't very well known. And the problem is that the chiral log term can't really be seen if the light quark mass is too large. So this is shown here. This was presented by Hashimoto. Notice the scale here. MS is this is a very funny scale, but this point here corresponds to the strange quark mass. So these are simulations where all the light quarks are bigger than the strange quark mass. And these results are basically totally, the results themselves are totally insensitive to the chiral logs. You can extrapolate without chiral logs or with chiral logs, and if you do the extrapolation in the different ways, you get a huge range for F sub B. You get a smaller range for F sub B sub S. But because you get such a huge range for F sub B, when you do the extrapolation, you also get a big error in the ratio. A similar analysis was performed by Kronfeld and Ryan of the chiral logs. They also said that really the uncertainty is much bigger than what people had thought about. There are various ways in which one can avoid this by looking at double ratios, for example, but really the solution is if I'm in this region here, I can distinguish between the, between the different extrapolations. So once I have simulations, which we will now have with light quark masses in this range, then this problem will go away and we will be able to get this ratio with good accuracy. Let me turn to semileptonic B meson decays, and I'm first going to talk about B to D and B to D star L nu, which is shown here. The differential decay rate is shown here, and this gives me a determination of VCB. Again, if I know this hadronic form factor, what people usually do is they, because the the low recoil limit is quite well known, one then extrapolates to the low recoil limit and uses the fact that this form factor is protected by symmetry. So what you need really is you need this form factor at zero recoil at omega equals 1. And people have calculated this form factor using heavy quark symmetry and then using another approach, for example, QCD sum rules or using quark models to calculate the deviations from one. You can do this calculation in lattice QCD, and there's a very cute trick that was worked out where if you calculate, instead of calculating the matrix element itself, you calculate this double ratio, you see that this double ratio is designed that in the limit where the quark masses are equal, it's identical to 1. And what we've shown is that double ratios such as this have very small errors, and that statistical errors and systematic errors scale not with R, but with R minus 1. So this is a way in which I can calculate not F, but F minus 1. Okay? And Kronfeld has shown that if I use the Fermilab action, which is order A, order 1 over M improved, then R is correct through 1 over terms that go like 1 over M squared, exactly what I need. That's, again, it's heavy quark symmetry that makes this true, just as it does in the continuum. So here are the results. And if you look at the results, our results, then we have, you know, we have an accuracy. These results are accurate to about few percent, but the accuracy on F minus 1 is 20 to 30%. So this is a calculation to a few percent accuracy on F, but it's really a very crummy calculation on F minus 1, and that's all that's needed. So these results were obtained in the quenched approximation. So some of these errors here will be removed once we use the milk configurations. And also, the Carl extrapolation error will be greatly reduced with the milk results. Here's a comparison of the lattice QCD result to results based on quark model and sum rule. And, you know, the point is that while the result right now is totally comparable, once you reduce the errors, this the lattice QCD result will be the best determination of this form factor at zero recall. And also, one would then want to extend the calculation beyond zero recoil to help the experimentalists with their extrapolation to zero recoil to improve the accuracy on VCB. So even though VCB is already quite well known, we will know it better, which is, of course, always a good thing. B to pi all new. There, what is problematic is the pion recoil momentum dependence, because you have such a large range, because the mass difference between the B meson and the pion is so big. I have a huge recoil momentum range for the pion, but I am limited by the accuracy of my action as to how high I can go. Roughly, right now, I can't go beyond a GeV or so with the actions that we have. So the more I improve my action, the more I can push this, but you're always pushing the limit. Experimentally, the differential decay rate typically is measured for large pion recoil momenta, so far away from zero. So this is a bit problematic if you want to use a lattice calculation together with experiment to extract VUB. In the olden days, we used to just use pole dominance to extrapolate down to Q squared equals zero. And of course, this is model dependence, which we don't want. So nowadays, we just get what we get over the recoil momentum range that we trust. Note that if I want to look at D to pi all nu, this is really not a problem. This is most of the recoil momentum range of the pion, or a significant enough fraction of the recoil momentum range. But this is still a bit of a problem if I want to compare B to pi all nu on the lattice with experiment to extract VUB. So here is the Fermilab calculation of the partial differential decay rate, and here's comparison. The errors are large, and the problem is that different people have different discretizations and so on. So the problem is that it is difficult to get to deal with the momenta still. And part of the reason why these errors are large is not just the momentum dependence, but also the Carl extrapolation, you know, shown here. If you really, if you really try to parametrize the Carl extrapolation different ways, you will get a large range here. So that's one of the dominant errors in this calculation. And again, I can certainly do much better if I'm over here rather than over here. So I've already discussed some of the recent developments, so let me review them here. We have highly improved actions now for the light quarks, and because these simulations have already been performed, it is obvious that these are actually computationally affordable with NF equals 3 over a range of light quark masses. So that's a big, big step forward that you know, that the Milk collaboration has made for the rest of the community. As far as heavy quark physics is concerned, the NRQCD action is currently correct through order A squared or order V to the 4, and they're in the process of including order V to the 6 terms. Our action is currently correct through order A or order P over M, and we're in the process of including order A squared, P squared over M squared, or order V to the 4 terms, depending on which system you look at. Another big step forward is the development of automated perturbation theory and making that, in really using that in perturbative calculations to get perturbative results for new actions as they're being developed. That's been a big holdup. And in fact, two loop calculations are now in progress. So, with the new Milk configurations, we have realistic C quark effects. And now, you know, we have something that really should resemble QCD. So lattice QCD should resemble QCD, and the only free parameters are the quark masses and the strong coupling. So I tune the lattice QCD parameters using experiment, just as I would normally do. So I fix the quark masses using certain meson masses, and then I determine the coupling using one of the split, using another quantity in either the J psi or the upsilon system. These splittings, these 1P1S splittings in these systems, are particularly good because they are actually quite independent of systematic errors, as we've seen. So now I can calculate a bunch of other quantities. Once I fixed the basic parameters of the QCD Lagrangian, of the lattice QCD Lagrangian, everything else I calculate is going to be a prediction. And I can compare that to experiment. So this is a plot that was compiled by Peter Lepage. These first 3 points were generated by the Milk collaboration. Then there's a bunch of splittings in the Upsilon system, and there's also a splitting in the Charmonium system. So this is ratio of lattice QCD results once I fixed all the free parameters divided by experiment with the milk configurations and in the quenched approximation. And you can see that, you know, some of these quantities are okay and some of these quantities are not so okay. You know, it's, as I said, 10 to 20 to 30% deviations in the quenched approximation. And so this is for quantities where I don't expect, you know, that, you know, some of the easiest quantities that I can calculate, where I don't expect 100% effect from the quenched approximation.
Ada, what do you mean by you use the lattice to fix mass parameters?
I calculate the pion mass on the lattice. And, you know, I do have to do the chiral extrapolation or the kaon mass or the J psi mass on the lattice. And then I adjust the lattice quark mass until the lattice calculation agrees with experiment. And that fixes the lattice quark mass that goes into my calculation.
Do you end up with the pi over 10 MeV, or is this some...
Okay, so the quark mass that you get is a lattice quark mass. Okay, so that's not the MS bar quark mass. So that's the quark mass that goes into the lattice Lagrangian. I can now translate that quark mass. You know, I can now use perturbation theory, one loop two loop perturbation theory. I need lattice perturbation theory to translate the lattice quark mass into an MS bar quark mass. You know, some of the perturbation theory has been done, and then I get an MS bar quark mass at whatever scale you want, and that's in fact right so far the best determination of the light quark masses that we have.
And so these are dressed masses?
No, these are MS bar masses. These are not dressed masses. These are also, you know, bare masses.
Weak masses.
Yes.
So what kind of masses do you get for the up and down?
You get the usual,
so 5 MeV.
Right, actually a little bit less than that.
But
But you have to put that in by hand in the beginning.
What do I put in by hand?
Your theory doesn't know anything about the weak interaction. So don't you have to put the 5 and 10 MeV in?
No. I mean, this QCD doesn't know anything about where the quark masses come from. That's right. The quark masses are a free parameter. And, you know, so by knowing the value of the pion mass, the value of the pion mass determines the value of the quark mass. Okay, so I'm using the theory itself doesn't have anything to say about the quark masses. Neither does it have anything to say about the coupling. Those have to be determined experimentally.
Rita, I couldn't help but notice that you don't have any masses on your plot of outputs, the role F parameters or splittings. Now, you just explained why you don't have M pi as an output either. You use that as an input.
Right.
But evidently, you trust the connection between M pi on the one hand and up, M up and M down as lattice masses on the other. And you use M pi to fix the lattice quark masses.
Right.
So now can you calculate the masses of some other hadrons as outputs?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there is one baryonic.
How well would they do?
There's one baryonic quantity. That's work in progress.
No, I mean it not splitting.
Ah, okay.
Number.
Yeah, so for example, the proton mass or, yeah.
I'll see that this afternoon if you come. You have just given a much more beautiful talk than I will, but I will show you a picture of the masses. Not all the chiral extrapolations are as beautiful as these, and we can talk about that.
Well, one of the issues is whether M up is 0 or 5 MeV, and so can you tell the difference?
Right now, what we're doing is we're averaging the up and down quark masses. So what we get out is an average of the up and down quark masses. So M up plus M down divided by 2.
And your results would be different if that average was, say, 5 MeV versus 10 MeV?
Yes. No. I mean, that's certainly true. If you look in the particle data book, and you look at the values, the quark mass values that are given there, those come from lattice QCD calculations of just the form that I've told you. What we will see pretty soon is that the particle data book, you know, at some point, the quark masses will have smaller error bars because now we can do these calculations with smaller errors. Now, you know, also in answer to Boris's question, we've looked at the simplest quantities here. And, you know, the quantities where we have good chiral extrapolations, where we expect systematic errors to be small. And there's still some other quantities, actually, in the D sub S and the B sub S system that are similar that we will, you know, that we will show. But some of the other quantities, as Bob said, you know, the chiral extrapolations don't work quite as well, some of the other baryonic quantities. So while we will get much better results than what was gotten before, they won't be quite as accurate. And so there's still more work to do. But I mean, you know, this is progress. So let me just say what our plans are. So NRQCD and Fermilab actions will be used. You know, we're continuing to do the calculation. Here's a preliminary result from our collaboration on the charmonium spectrum, and this is at a fixed light quark mass of about a quarter of the strange quark mass. So this is without the chiral extrapolation. This is work in progress, you know. And then we will study the lattice spacing dependence, etc. Similarly, Milk is doing, you know, is looking at the light meson system and the light baryon system, and we're also going to look at D sub S, B, and B sub S. And in fact, the charm sector is going to be very interesting because if we can look at decay constants and semileptonic form factors in the charm system, we can compare them with CLIO-C. There will be an experiment, CLIO-C, which will predict or, you know, hopefully post-dict, because hopefully we'll get there first, some of these quantities. And test lattice QCD. So if we can get the calculations to a few percent accuracy and the experiment to a few percent accuracy, then we can really test lattice QCD at the few percent level. I'm running out of time. Let me just flash the dirty laundry for you. We need to test our light and heavy quark actions, and this is certainly fine. We have two totally independent formulations for heavy quarks. But for light quarks, right now, we only have the improved staggered fermions. I told you that with Wilson fermions, you know, the computational effort right now is really very, very difficult. And what is the problem with staggered fermions? Well, Tom asked the question about how one deals with, you know, what's staggered about a staggered fermion. With the you know, identifying some of the staggered flavors, you know, and staggering them to make one flavor, one still ends up with four flavors. So if I have 2 + 1 staggered fermions, I have to, for two flavors, I have to take the square root of the determinant in my path integral. To make one flavor, I have to take the fourth root of the determinant. That's a non-local operation, and you may worry about whether the staggered lattice QCD is still same as QCD. We know that this is true at short distances. The structure is completely taking the square root of the determinant is completely well understood. Perturbatively, there is no problem in perturbation theory, and this has been shown through one loop perturbation theory, and will be done through two loops also. Non-perturbatively, we know that the non-perturbative quark loop structure, the stuff that gives rise to chiral logarithms, is also okay, and in fact, the short distance corrections to these chiral logarithms, the A squared errors, have recently been calculated in a tour de force by Bernard and collaborators within the Mill collaboration. So the test that I just showed you is one is needed in order to test staggered lattice QCD against experiment. It is the most precise test that we have of the staggered formalism, that in fact it corresponds, that staggered lattice QCD is the same as QCD. Another issue, which I don't have time to talk about, is how to deal with B meson decays at high recoil, and there is a new framework which was developed by Foley and Lepage, which may allow us to get to high recoil momenta. So let me conclude. Let me put my conclusions up. I mean, I've said most of these things already. The big point is that if our tests of the staggered action work out, then we're now in a situation where we can do a wide variety of lattice QCD calculations that haven't really been possible before with quantitative real error estimates and hopefully to a few percent accuracy for a wide variety. This is not all of the QCD problems that we can deal with, but at least some of them, and that's real progress. So that's it.